This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, each year, assets seized by the New York Police Department in the millions are filling the city's coffers.
We're not sure where the money goes. We think it eventually ends up in the hands of the New York City Police Department, but we do know it's millions and millions of dollars stolen from poor people.
Governor Andrew Cuomo recently issued an executive order directing agencies under his jurisdiction to stop dealing with organizations supporting BDS.
Governor Cuomo's father, who was also a governor, supported the boycott movement when it was aimed against the racist South African apartheid regime. His son is on the wrong side of this one.
After many years, we have a positive update in the case of Rosmea O'Day in Detroit.
Her attorney, Michael Deutsch, won a new trial for Ms. O'Day, and it looks like this time they might win. Why does the IRS need guns? That's the title of a guest editorial in the Wall Street Journal written 2 weeks ago by our guest Adam Andrzejewski. We talked to him about the huge military buildup of non-defense organizations in our government.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Antiquated civil forfeiture procedures in New York City are causing many, including the city's poorest, to have their assets seized to fill the city's coffers. In what many call a gross violation of civil liberties, the Office of Management and Budget Report revealed that the police department seized over $5 million through an opaque but very common process of civil forfeiture in 2013. Notably, millions of dollars come when people arrested in the Bronx upon release are not given back their cash or personal property. The burden to retrieve this property falls on the owner. They're required to get a release form from the Bronx DA's office within 270 days, but often the DA ignores their requests. To talk about this problem, we speak with attorney Molly Covell of the Bronx Defenders. On June 3rd, she filed an amended complaint seeking class action status in federal court in support of these victims of official theft.
Attorney Molly Covell from the Bronx Defenders, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, Molly, you're lead counsel in a lawsuit that's been dear to our hearts, the notion of civil forfeiture for years. You and the Bronx law firm of Boies, Schiller, and Flexner have applied for class action status in a suit challenging New York City and really ripping off poor people of their cash and their cell phones and other properties. And the lead plaintiff is a man named Victor Encarnacion. And I wanted to ask you to start off explaining the story. What happened to Mr. Encarnacion, and what are you doing about it?
Sure. So Victor is a sort of emblematic of many, many clients that the Bronx Defenders represents every year. We're a holistic defender organization, and we represent about 40% of all people who are arraigned in the Bronx every year. And that comes to almost 31,000 people every year. And many of them are charged, as Victor was charged, with drug felonies. And his case was dismissed, like very, very many drug felony cases in the Bronx. People are cycled through the system, and oftentimes the prosecutors realize, as they did with him, that they didn't have a good case. They weren't going to be able to prove their case, and so they just dropped the charges. And this happens literally thousands of times a year. As with every person, essentially, charged with drug felonies in the Bronx, Victor's cell phone and cash were seized as part of the processing of his arrest, and they were vouchered as arrest evidence. So if you're arrested and you have a house keys and a wallet, those things are usually categorized for safekeeping, which means that when you get out of jail, you get to go pick them up. But when something is categorized as arrest evidence, the state essentially has the right to keep it through the time that you're being prosecuted, because they say that this stuff is going to be used to prove their case at trial. And frequently we don't really see that, you know, in being that determination being made in good faith. There's a lot of times where it really doesn't make sense to categorize someone's cell phone as arrest evidence. The problem that we are challenging in our class action lawsuit is really one of what happens when the case is dismissed, and there couldn't possibly be a trial at that point, right? Because there's nothing to try. There's no more charges. And Victor tried to pick up his phone and his cash after the dismissal, and he was basically given the instruction to go get what's called a DA's release, which puts this burden on the property claimant to go essentially prove that their property is innocent, because they have to go up to the DA's office and beg them for this piece of paper, and the DA's don't really have a system to track those requests or grant those releases within a timely time frame. So he got no response until actually we filed the lawsuit, and then about 8 months after his case had been dismissed and sealed, he got his phone back. We amended the complaint to add two more plaintiffs who are in a very similar, you know, circumstances where they had charges that were dismissed and arrest evidence that they could not pick up. And this is sort of a side effect, if you will, of, you know, broken windows policing and sort of the mass incarceration crisis of our country, is that, you know, all people who are arrested essentially have stuff taken from them during that arrest. And the process for getting it back is so daunting and puts such a burden on the property owner that essentially our understanding is thousands of people give up every year. And so the government basically takes in millions of dollars in unclaimed funds. They're reporting this every year as sort of income to the NYPD budget.
When these people are released from the criminal justice system and they try to regain their cash or their property or their cell phones, and they're given the runaround so they can't get it back, that the money goes to the police department? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, we actually are trying to find out exactly how it works, because this city is not very transparent with how the money gets disposed and how often this happens. They don't actually keep public records of unclaimed funds and the source of the unclaimed funds. But every year they file in city council a budget document that reports revenue from the NYPD. And this is one of the major sources of revenue. Now, compared to the NYPD budget of billions of dollars, you know, this is $5 million or $6 million every year. But if you compare it to the number of dollars seized from each individual person, which can be, you know, $30, $50, or $2,000, it adds up. It's quite a large number of transactions. And it's $6 million, you know, where does the money go? I think it goes to the general fund, and then it comes back to the NYPD. But, you know, it's again, very unclear, because the city police department does not keep public records on this. And we've been trying to track down those records. We've been having such a hard time through the Freedom of Information Law. We've actually introduced a bill in city council that will force the NYPD to be more transparent with how they dispose of this property annually. So that bill was sponsored by Councilmember Richie Torres from the Bronx, and co-sponsored by Dan Gorodnick, and they are planning a hearing in September in City Council to really shine a light on these very shadowy transactions that that the police department are doing every year. At any given time, the police department is keeping about $60 million in bank accounts. That are all from seized, you know, just cash, right? Then setting aside the cash, there's all kinds of other physical, tangible property that they seize. You know, many hundreds of cars every year are seized, and a lot of that property is auctioned off after someone, you know, fails to pick it up within a specified time frame. But in our understanding, in our experience, a lot of people don't pick it up because they just don't understand how to, and the process is so ornate.
Molly, I understand that since the New York City Administrative Code governing forfeiture was written way back in 1881, there have been several court rulings that have modified the procedure. And in one in 1972, the court found the city hadn't been providing due process to predominantly poor and minority New Yorkers. And it called the code unconstitutional. What's the status, if any, of pursuing this in court as well as through the city council?
So the city council bill that is already introduced is just a transparency bill. But I do understand that the city council will also be trying to amend the actual forfeiture codes over the next year or so. Because, yes, you are correct. They have actually been called unconstitutional a number of times, and every time the Second Circuit addresses it, they note that the burdens are unconstitutionally placed on the property owner to pick up their stuff and to prove the stuff's innocence. The case I believe you're referring to is McClendon. That case, which came down from the Second Circuit in 1972, was also revisited in the 90s, and actually the regulations that we're challenging in our lawsuit were developed as a response to that lawsuit, the McClendon lawsuit, and they were developed because, you know, even with a district attorney sign off, the NYPD was still saying that people had to basically sue them to get their stuff back, and so they revised the regulations of the city, saying essentially that if you had a DA's release, police department had to give the stuff back unless they filed a forfeiture case. Now, the problem is that the DAs are negligent in responding to requests for DAs releases, and that process itself is still, in our opinion, just too high a hurdle, too high a burden placed on the property owner. So the piece of the system that we're challenging in our class action lawsuit is where cases are terminated and there's no affirmative showing now by the government that they need the property. And so essentially some time has elapsed, a couple days, a couple weeks from the day of the termination of the case. And there could never be, you know, a trial on these cases because most of them are dismissed. And so we think that the process has to be streamlined yet again, even after the, you know, successive waves of litigation. The other major case that people may have heard of in this area is Crimstock versus Kelly, which also went to the Second Circuit multiple times. And that case really focused on cars that were seized as instrumentality of crime. And, you know, the sort of most obvious example of that is DWI charges, where someone is arrested for drunk driving, and the car is seized in virtually every single case I've seen where those charges are filed. But there's also been, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of cars seized every year for drug charges, where someone, or for prostitution charges, where someone is sort of in the car when a drug crime is conducted, or uses the car to drive to the place, and the NYPD seizes thousands of cars a year. And the Crimstock case gave people the right to get their car back before their criminal charges were disposed of, so they have a right to an administrative hearing before they go to trial, which, if you've been following the Bronx Defender's other lawsuit, getting to trial, at least in the Bronx, can take many years. The right to trial has been severely eroded by the delay in the court system. So the Crimstock versus Kelly is a very important case that gives people the right to try to get their extremely important, valuable property, such as a car, back pending the charges. But I think that, you know, outside of our own case, what we also need to do is institute Crimstock-type hearings for other important properties, such as cell phones. I mean, the average New Yorker uses a cell phone far more often than their car, and although cell phones are worth, you know, are worth less than most cars, the actual utility of a cell phone in someone's life now is certainly quite high. And so I would like to see eventually a challenge to the seizure of cell phones pending the, you know, outcome of cases, and allow people to get those phones back through an administrative process like people can get cars back.
Absolutely. Molly Covell at the Bronx Defenders, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Keep up your good legal work up there. And we want to hear from you again when you win this one. It seems to Heidi and me that this is a winner. And we want to talk to you again when it's concluded. So you take it easy and good luck.
Thanks. Well, we have a great team up here, and we're excited to be working on this issue, which we, again, think needs to have a lot more light shown on it.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Molly. Yeah.
So long, Molly.
Bye-bye.
See you. Bye-bye.
The New York legislature has tried over the past year, without success, to pass laws protecting Israel against the Boycotts, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, or BDS, for its illegal occupation of Palestinian lands. In a clearly unconstitutional move, given that the government may not penalize individuals or entities on the basis of free expression, Governor Andrew Cuomo recently issued an executive order directing all agencies under his jurisdiction to cease dealing with companies and organizations that support BDS. The order calls for Cuomo's commissioner to compile a list of institutions and companies that support a boycott of Israel. The list will be publicly posted. Several groups, including the National Lawyers Guild, Palestine Legal, and CCR, wrote a legal memo critical of the anti-BDS bills pending in the New York legislature. More than 100 churches, human rights groups, and legal organizations also signed a letter to the New York legislature opposing the legislation, saying, quote, "It would chill and deter constitutionally protected speech by intimidating people from engaging in political actions for fear of being blacklisted." Here to discuss Cuomo's executive order is Dima Khalidi of Palestine Legal. Dima, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me again.
In light of Andrew Cuomo's recent executive order calling on entities in New York State not to do business with those who have endorsed BDS, can you give us a brief overview of other such measures across the nation?
Yeah, we've been seeing these kinds of legislative initiatives since 2014, in fact, after the American Studies Association passed a resolution to endorse the academic boycott of Israel. And we saw several measures in 2014. The latest wave of bills that we've seen have focused, similar to Cuomo's executive order, on prohibiting the state from investing in or contracting with companies or entities that boycott Israel. In some cases, even individuals that boycott Israel. So, to give you a sense of the scope of this, we know that anti-BDS laws have been enacted in 9 states, actually signed by the governor in 9 states, and those include Indiana, Illinois, South Carolina, Iowa, Florida, and a few others, Arizona, Colorado. We know just this year at least 9 other states have considered or are considering similar anti-BDS legislation. So we see something pending in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Maryland. So the current wave of laws are all very similar. They contain very similar language, and they're all focused on prohibiting the state from, you know, using its resources to investing in companies that boycott Israel.
If the language in these various bills are similar, is there certain entities behind sponsoring these?
Well, it does seem like there are different entities involved in different places. In Illinois, you know, we know that the Jewish Federation here was involved. You know, it depends in different states. A Christian right organization is known to be behind some of them, or at least championing them. But there are major Jewish organizations, Zionist organizations, that are pushing this kind of legislation around the country.
Dima, years ago, the boycott was used very effectively to support agricultural workers, particularly out in California. And then maybe 20 years or so ago, the boycott was used effectively as pressure against the South African apartheid government. And boycotts seemed then to be an honorable First Amendment right of people to protest. But do you see an irony here in this anti-BDS legislation?
Yeah, I mean, the right to boycott has been affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court when it considered civil rights boycotts against white businesses in Mississippi in the 1960s. The decision didn't come down until the early 80s, but, you know, the Supreme Court has said that boycotts to affect political, social, and economic change are protected First Amendment activities. And, that's what we're talking about here, that this is a boycott that is intended to address injustices against Palestinians, and it's exactly the kind of boycott that is addressing a political issue that is on a matter of public concern and is protected First Amendment activity. Now, the folks who are introducing these kinds of bills are, you know, claiming that this is not really the intention of the boycott movement, that it's, in fact, just discriminatory and anti-Semitic. So, you know, it will come down to a kind of reckoning about what the BDS movement really is about. And, you know, I think it's important to get the message across about the boycott. And I think these bills provide an opportunity to really do that in the media and elsewhere, to make clear that this is a human rights movement that we're talking about. And the suppression of the movement and of BDS activities, you know, violates fundamental constitutional rights.
Dima, Governor Cuomo's executive order also calls for his commissioner to compile a list of institutions and companies that support BDS, and for that list to be posted publicly. That sounds dangerously close to a blacklist, doesn't it?
It does, and we've been comparing it to McCarthyist-type blacklists. You know, it's very chilling for organizations, entities to be publicly named by the state as companies that are disfavored. That's one of the aspects of the executive order and other bills as well, other laws that have passed that we've seen, that is very troubling and that we think presents serious for, constitutional concerns.
Dima Khalidi from Palestine Legal, before we let you go, can you tell us how people can get a hold of Palestine Legal and how they can follow up on this continuing story?
Yeah, our website is palestinelegal.org, and we are also tracking legislation around the country at righttoboycott.org. That's our 2 as in T-O. righttoboycott.org. So there are ways to take action there and to follow the various developments around the country.
Well, Attorney Dima Khalidi from Palestine Legal, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye, Dima.
Bye-bye.
Palestinian-born Razmea is now a United States citizen, an icon of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. She was convicted in 2014 of unlawful procurement of naturalization. She had answered no to the American immigration questionnaire as to whether she'd ever been arrested or convicted. She is now seeking reversal of this immigration fraud conviction. Razmea was sent into exile by Zionists in 1948 and then again in 1967. She was arrested by the Israeli military in 1969 and falsely confessed to a bombing after being tortured and repeatedly raped in jail. A military court convicted her, and she served 10 years in prison. She was then released in a prisoner exchange and immigrated to the United States. We speak today with her attorney, Michael Deutsch, former legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a partner in the renowned Chicago civil rights law firm, the People's Law Office.
Attorney Michael Deutsch, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's glad. I'm glad to be here.
And we're very happy to have you back, Michael. Congratulations on your victory in the Razmea Ouda case and getting what looks like it's going to be a new trial for her. Tell our listeners who she is and what happened to her.
Okay, Razmea Ouda is a Palestinian woman, 68 years old, been living in the United States for 20 years. She's the deputy director of the Arab American Action Network, AAAN they're called. They're based in Chicago. They do a lot of community work, pro-Palestine work, work around immigration, work with youth. And she has been very active in organizing immigrant women, Arab women. She has a committee of over 600 women, and she's been educating them and getting them involved in the community. And she's a dynamo, an incredible woman. Several years ago, she was indicted for allegedly lying on her naturalization questionnaire and interview. She answered the questions that she had not been imprisoned or convicted of a crime or even charged with a crime. And it turns out that in 1969, she was part of a group of people, 500 or more, that were swept up and arrested, who were active in opposing the occupation, the recent occupation began in 1967, of the West Bank by the Israelis. She was a college student at the time, and she was horrifically tortured for over 30 days, sexually abused. Her father was tortured in front of her, and she was then allegedly confessed to being involved in couple of bombings that the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine took credit for. She had a military trial in front of judges, soldiers acting as judges. She was naturally convicted, as almost all Palestinians are convicted in the military courts. She was given a life sentence and went to prison. And in 1979, 10 years later, she was swapped with several other political prisoners for an Israeli soldier. She went to live in Lebanon and then in Jordan, and she was very active in helping refugees in Jordan. And then she came to the United States. Her father, who was a U.S. citizen, was suffering from cancer. The family asked her to come there to help out. And she did, and she was living in Michigan and helping out with her father. And then she, 5 or 6 years later, she came to Chicago, and she saw that she could be active and help in the Arab community. So she had a green card, and she decided that she would apply for naturalization so she could continue with her political work.
And she became an American citizen.
Yeah, she's an American citizen, and she's been an American citizen since 2002. 2004, I'm sorry. So, and what happened is, essentially, she's living here and no problems, you know, no arrests, no convictions. And in 2010, the FBI began an investigation of the Palestinian Solidarity Movement in the Midwest, and particularly in Chicago. They carried out a series of raids of activists. They convened a grand jury and subpoenaed 23 organizers to a grand jury, and they were targeting the AAAN. And as a result of targeting the AAAN, they learned of Rasmia O'Day, and they contacted the Israeli authorities and had them do some kind of background search of her, and they learned that she had this, you know, conviction back in 1969 and was in prison. So they couldn't do anything against these activists. There was never an indictment brought against them, even though their homes were raided and there was this whole grand jury. So the next best thing was to go after Rasmia, who was a very well-respected member of the community. And rather than charge her in Chicago, where she has incredible support, they charged her in Detroit with lying on her naturalization, which is a felony, which has up to 10 years in prison, and they put her on trial in the federal court in Detroit. The prosecutor was a fervent Zionist, you know, out front, you know, talking about terrorism, and we basically said that she had been tortured and that she suffers from post-traumatic stress. She was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress by one of the leading experts on torture and the effects of torture, and that she never knowingly lied when she filled out her naturalization papers, because she had repressed that information and didn't think it was relevant in any event, and therefore she shouldn't be convicted. The judge refused to let us put on the post-traumatic stress evidence. He refused to let us put any evidence that she was tortured. He refused to let us challenge the whole process, the military court process, the denial of due process that she experienced when she was arrested and convicted in Israel. And he refused to even let us voir dire the jury about Palestine-Israel, saying it was totally irrelevant to the to the case. Meanwhile, at the same time, he allows the government to put in this indictment, which accuses her of bombings and even the names of the victims of the bombings, and may they rest in peace, in the indictment. And so she's accused of being a terrorist and accused of being involved in bombings, and we're not able to put on any defense. So predictably, she's convicted. The judge gives her 18 months in prison, and we appeal. And the Sixth Circuit, which sits in Cincinnati, Ohio, found that her PTSD evidence would have been relevant, that it was a denial of her right to fair trial by prohibiting her to put on the expert, although they left the door open to say if there's any other reason why the PTSD testimony shouldn't be admitted, there should be a hearing back in the district court. Interestingly, there was a concurrence that said it was prejudicial to put in this language from the indictment about people being killed, but they said it was harmless error. But then there was a dissent by one of the most conservative judges in the Sixth Circuit, who basically said that by allowing the government to put on this evidence of the bombings and the fact that she was convicted of it, but not letting her put on her testimony that she was tortured and that she was subjected to a military tribunal, was stacked the deck against her and didn't give her a fair trial. At one hand, she got the short end of the stick, both ends of the stick. That's what the court said. And now the Court of Appeals, it says the evidence is relevant. What the government now is going to try and do, and they're opposing the admissibility of the PTSD expert, is they're going to say, number one, she doesn't have PTSD because she's a malingerer. And number two, that the methodology that the expert used, this one, the leading expert in the world on PTSD, is flawed, and therefore the expert shouldn't be able to testify. Interesting, when we went to court this Monday, the judge at first set a trial date and set the date for pretrial motions and motions in limine, et cetera. And then when the government said, oh, no, Judge, we weren't going to challenge the admissibility, then he kind of reevaluated and said, all right, well, I'll let the government do what they're going to do. But he still set a trial date, which is January. So the implication to me, and based on reading the law, understanding what the Sixth Circuit said, is we're going to have a trial. They may want to make a record on Daubert, but at the end of the day, we're going to have a new trial. And in that new trial, we're going to be able to put on the fact that she suffers from post-traumatic stress. And obviously, the reason she suffers from post-traumatic stress is that she was horrifically tortured. So the torture is going to come in. And, of course, I'm sure the government is going to try and oppose it, saying they don't torture it. And I think it will open the door to the whole history of systematic torture by the Israelis of Palestinian political people, political organizers. And this is back in 1969 when they were torturing people, you know, systematically and horrifically, and before they even had some kind of cover about, oh, we don't torture anymore, oh, we only torture if there's a ticking time bomb kind of defense that they've raised more recently. So she's out on bond, on appeal bond. At first, the judge locked her up. The judge was upset after the trial because she insisted on saying she was innocent and that she had been tortured and the judge had, in violation of the judge's order. And so he locked her up right after the conviction, but we convinced him to let her out, and then we got an appeal bond. So she's out. She's back in the community. She's back doing the work she had been doing for almost 10 years now, over 10 years. And so, you know, every day she's back and free is a victory, and we're confident that we will have a new trial, which will be a more complete exploration of the whole Palestinian-Israeli issue.
If people want to continue following this story, Michael, is there a website they can go to or a defense group?
Yeah, there is a freerasmia.com. victorsdiscourse.org is one thing they can follow. And there's also the Arab American Action Network.org is another website. And so, and of course, the Electronic Intifada always covers her case, so they can always get updates on the Electronic Intifada about her situation.
Now, it seems to me that the State Department knew about this, the other people in the government knew about this, but it seems to me that they selectively prosecuted her. And stepping back with that notion in mind, how do you evaluate the way Palestinians have been treated in American courts?
Well, there's several cases which show that they have been selectively prosecuted. They had been indicted and imprisoned for providing charitable support for people living under occupation. They've been criminalized for their First Amendment activity. The case of Samuel Arian is one. The Holy Land case, where they got the horrific sentences for merely providing charitable support for people in occupied territories. The case of Mohammed Salah, which was in Chicago, where he was horrifically tortured, and they got a confession on him, and then they charged him when he came back from Israel with a RICO charge, saying he was a member of a racketeering organization, i.e. Hamas, that he was the world commander of Hamas, which was rejected by the jury, and he was acquitted of those serious charges. So, yeah, there has been a whole history of politically motivated criminal cases against Palestinians. And, of course, we know what they're doing on college campuses, what Cuomo is now doing with this, executive order about BDS. And if you follow Palestine Legal, which is part of CCR, you can get an update on all the discriminatory activities that are going on against Palestinians who are just trying to educate people in the U.S. about what's the truth about what's going on, rather than the propaganda you get in the mass media.
Yeah, exactly. I was struck that Razma, in 1948, was a refugee driven out of her village in 48. One of the victims of ethnic cleansing when the State of Israel was set up. 750,000 Arabs were driven out. And then the government of Israel landed on their heads again in 1967 after the 67 war, when the country of Israel expanded again into the occupied territories. So Razmi Odeh is a true hero to stand up to all of this. And Michael, frankly, so are you, providing this excellent representation for her. You've kept her in the streets. You've kept the work going. We're grateful for your excellent legal representation. And we look forward to having you back on Law and Disorder to report on the next developments in the case. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the support that you've given her case, and it's important for her and for all people who are supporting her that her story gets distributed as widely as possible.
Thank you, Attorney Michael Deutsch. Take it easy.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
There is a growing arsenal at paper-pushing federal agencies with firearm and arrest authority that have expanded their arsenals since 2006, including the Small Business Administration, Social Security Administration, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Education Department, the Energy Department, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and the Smithsonian Institute. Special agents at the IRS, for example, have AR-15 military-style rifles, and nearly 4,000 Department of Veterans Affairs personnel are armed. In fact, the number of officers authorized to arrest and carry weapons exceeds the number of Marines. Recently, the group OpenTheBooks.com released an oversight report on the federal government's purchase of guns, ammunition, and military-type equipment. Over $335 million was spent by agencies we traditionally think of as administrative or regulatory, such as the U.S. Mint or the Smithsonian Institution. Here to talk about this development is Adam Andrzejewski. In 2007, he founded For the Good of Illinois to educate, engage, and empower citizens to demand transparency and accountability. He also founded the transparency website OpenTheBooks.com and launched it by posting the salaries and pensions of all 1 million Illinois public employees. Today, OpenTheBooks.com is the world's largest private repository of public spending records with 2.6 billion individually captured transactions from the federal government. Recently, he co-authored an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal with former Senator Tom Coburn on the militarization of the federal government bureaucracy. Adam Andrzejewski, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Excellent. I'm happy to be on the program. Thank you very much, Michael, for your interest in our work.
Well, your work is just extraordinary. What you've released here, I read the article that you wrote in the Wall Street Journal, and what you've uncovered here, I think, is really fundamental to the kind of country and culture we want to have. On June 17th, that your organization, OpenTheBooks.com, released an oversight report on what you call the militarization of America. And I'd like to know, Adam, what you mean by the militarization of America, and might you please give us some examples of this?
So this was the second report that we had released, kind of in a series describing what the militarization of America now looks like. The first one was about a month ago when we gave the updated figures over the course of the last 10 years on the transfer of military surplus gear from the Department of Defense to local police departments across America. And so that was a very, very interesting report. It covered about $2.3 billion worth of DOD, Department of Defense, transfer of military gear to the local police chiefs across the country. This is the second report, and it details, for the first time ever, we expose with a bright spotlight the 67 federal agencies that purchased guns, ammunition, and military-style equipment over the course of the last 9 years, and it was $1.5 billion worth of procurement.
You know, and this is not, we're not talking about agencies that need guns. For example, you write in the Wall Street Journal article, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service spent $4.77 million purchasing shotguns, 30-08 caliber rifles, night vision goggles, propane cannons, liquid explosives, pyro supplies, buckshot, LP gas cannons, drones, remote control helicopters, thermal cameras, military waterproof thermal infrared scopes, and more. I mean, this is the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services. You know, give us some more examples. This is really something gone wild.
So that for the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, they have 140 employees throughout the country, and so all of the, you know, the nearly $5 million worth of procurement was for those 140 special officers within that unit. You know, we discovered that the VA, for example, I mean, you and I both remember like yesterday, hopefully one of the worst scandals we'll ever witness in our lifetime. It was 2 years ago, when sick veterans at the nexus of the scandal couldn't get in to see a doctor at the VA and had, you know, thousands of them died waiting in line. Well, 20 years ago, the VA had zero employees with arrest and firearm power, and now the VA has nearly 4,000 employees with arrest and firearm power. They spent $11 million procuring guns, ammunition, and military-style equipment. And the list of the 53... But what you and I would consider regulatory or administrative agencies purchasing guns, ammunition, and military-style equipment amounted to 25 cents on every dollar worth of this kind of procurement.
So it's really unbelievable. I mean, even the Smithsonian Institution, which is kind of a library and a museum, are arming up.
That's true. So we go through the EPA. Last fall, I did an oversight report on the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and at the time, we made Fox News six times by exposing the millions of dollars spent on their guns and ammunition and military style equipment that they had procured at the EPA. It struck people as outside of their mission. We now know that with the release of this report, that the EPA ranks 26th out of the federal agencies. And so you do have 14 traditional law enforcement agencies housed within the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security, and these have a legitimate law enforcement purpose. Then you have 53 rank and file, what we would call paper pushing, regulatory, administrative, general purpose agencies that also have employees, over 30,000 employees with arrest and firearm authority.
Well, let's talk about who some of these agencies are. Social Security, for example, or the Small Businesses Administration. Give us some other examples.
One of the ones that I've been talking about but hasn't got a lot of ink yet is Health and Human Services. And so we had noticed in our data when we quantified it that they had spent over $110 million on weaponry over the course of the last 9 years. And that just struck us out of the normal course of their health mission. So we explored it with the spokesperson, and they were able to account for nearly all of it, except for about $7 million worth of weaponry. We detailed this in the report, and our findings include the fact that they have about 200 special agents over at over at HHS, and they have the latest in heavy weaponry, and they're trained by the same contractors that train our United States Special Forces.
Amazing. I know you write that the non-Defense Department federal officers who are authorized to make arrests and carry firearms are 200,000 people, and that exceeds the number of U.S. Marines, which is only 182,000. So there seems to me this militarization that's bubbling up in non-military organizations.
I'm from Illinois, so I'm pretty jaded, especially since I'm in the we're the nation's leading transparency organization. We've captured and displayed 3 billion lines of government spending. And in Illinois, our number one manufactured product is corruption. It's hard to impress me with government spending. But I have to tell you, when we were working on our Wall Street Journal editorial, and Dr. Tom Coburn, and many in your listening audience remember, he's the former senator from Oklahoma. He was Time Magazine 2014, 100 most influential persons in the world. He made that list. And Coburn says, and he used to head up the Senate Oversight Committee on Homeland Security. And he said, I remember, and see if the data bears this out, are there more federal officers with arrest and firearm authority now than United States Marines? Well, we knew how many United States Marines there are. There's 182,000. And so we set out to see if the numbers would bear it out, and they do. There are over 200,000 of these federal officers, and probably significantly so. For reasons of national security, for instance, the number of TSA officers aren't disclosed, nor do we know an accurate number over at different federal agencies, such as the Department of Agriculture.
You know, I wanted to follow the dollar here, Adam. First of all, what kind of money are we talking about? And then secondly, my surmise is the reason that these various agencies are purchasing everything from armored personnel carriers to hollow point bullets is that the lobbyists are encouraging them, encouraging Congress and the various agencies to do this purchasing, and then they do purchase them, and everybody's happy. The companies make money, the lobbyists are performing their function, and we get more and more militarized. What's your take on what's driving this? Is it a follow-the-dollar situation?
We have not explored it from that angle, but our data did turn up an interesting story, which I think you'll that your listeners will find pretty incredible. So one of the top three since 2006, the weapon contractor that is in the top three in terms of these rank-and-file federal agencies outside of the Department of Defense, the name is Gold Belt Wolf, and they're actually a foreign LLC because they're owned by an indigenous tribe in Alaska. They didn't exist before, I think, about 2005, and they started with a federal loan, from the Small Business Administration. And today, on these non-military, on the procurement of guns and ammunition from these non-military federal agencies, they are ranked number three in our database as to their weapons provider.
Let me step back for a second and just ask you, what law has made this transparency possible. How were you able to develop all this data for people?
So it was the great law done on a bipartisan basis between the then great senator from Oklahoma, Tom Coburn, and the then great senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. And they got together in 2006 on what euphemistically is called the Google Your Government Act. And for the first time ever, they opened up the federal checkbook. And as a result of that law, this is what makes our work possible.
What do you think the civil liberties concerns are raised by this militarization?
So I'm not a constitutional scholar. Coburn would know this much better than I do, being in the United States Senate for two terms. He honored his two-term pledge. He was on CNBC today, and he doesn't think it's constitutional. So he did call for a change in policy, and he said he supports an assault weapons ban on the IRS and the other regulatory agencies, which I thought was pretty interesting.
I just wanted to tell you, I'm from Illinois also, and what you said about corruption in your state really rings a bell. Lenny Bruce used to say that Chicago was so corrupt it was thrilling. I get a whiff of that corruption from reading your report. How do people get a hold of your full report, Adam?
If your listening audience would come to openthebooks.com, and then in the report section, it's the first report. It's the militarization of America. We actually, within the report, have released all of the raw data sets. So there's 36,000 over the course of 9 years individual federal transactions. And you're not only can your listening audience read the 53-page report, which reads fairly quickly, but they can also analyze the line-by-line spending transactions that procured this $1.5 billion worth of guns, ammunition, and military-style equipment in the non-defense agencies.
You know, I've read some of the report, and you have some extraordinary highlights in the report, and I wonder whether you would share that with our audience.
Well, the just the accounting mistakes were significant. When we audited the procurement and the spending in the federal checkbook, we found tens of millions of dollars worth of mistakes. For example, they were miscoded. We have nearly 6% of all transactions on guns and ammunition that were miscoded, wrongly coded. Some of these purchases were actually for ping pong balls, gym equipment, bread, copiers, cotton balls, cable television, including a line item description that was coded underneath a gun or an ammunition category. It was from the Coast Guard, and it was entered as Cable Dude.
I know. You know, you write in your Wall Street Journal editorial that the federal government has become a gun show that never adjourns. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the best example, the best and most descriptive example, and for space, the editorial board had to cut this paragraph, but here's a great example. So we added up all the procurement orders since 2005 at DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and we found that they have purchased 1.7 billion bullets since 2004, which seems like a massive arsenal considering we're only 320 million people in the country.
Yeah.
It's six bullets for everybody. However, in 2014, when Coburn was on the committee in the Senate on oversight of Homeland Security, he commissioned the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, to study the bullet reserve over at DHS, and they found that DHS had a 160 million bullet reserve. That is a gun show that never ends. One of the interesting statistics to follow up on that is in a five-year period between 2008 through 2012, in the line of duty, DHS, Department of Homeland Security agents, only fired off 881 rounds, yet they have a bullet inventory of 160 million bullets.
You also write that the Food and Drug Administration employs 183 heavily armed special agents for the Food and Drug Administration. And then another statistic that I thought was chilling was you say that the University of California in Berkeley acquired 14 assault rifles, and Yale University police have 20 assault rifles, and that Texas Southern University and Saddleback College police acquired mine-resistant vehicles. I mean, how do you explain that?
So this is part of the federal 1033 program, which takes military surplus gear from the battlefields, from gear that the Department of Defense isn't using any longer, and it has transferred $5 billion since the inception of this program to local law enforcement agencies. And since everybody has a police force nowadays, we found over 6,000 local police departments across the country were recipients of this gear. Now, we mapped it all. So we mapped the last 10 years' worth of transfer, and we've updated it in 2013 and 14. The New York Times, exposed this program and did a nice job with it. We updated the last 2 years' worth of that distribution. That's on the map alongside 8 other years. So actually, your listening audience, if you come to openthebooks.com, click on the Maps tab. The first map that renders and opens is you can look at your own police departments and see what was transferred locally from the Department of Defense.
That's very helpful. We've been speaking with Adam Andrzejewski from openthebooks.com on the information that he's recently released in a report on how the agencies of the U.S. government, not military agencies, just normal agencies like the Small Business Administration, are beefing up their arsenal. And I want to just ask you one last question because we're kind of running out of time, Adam. What are your personal concerns about this kind of military buildup?
So, I've been asked this, and I guess in real time, I don't fear it. You play this out over the course of time, though, with what you see on campuses, with the constriction of the First Amendment and the lack of dissent, both from the, from the right and from the left. It just seems like if you shut down free speech on college campuses and then those people go into law enforcement, you can envision the day when these weapons would come full circle on we the people. I guess I just don't like the infrastructure in place.
And with that, we thank you, Adam, and we say goodbye, and we truly appreciate the work that OpenTheBooks.com is doing, and we truly appreciate your work, Adam. Thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your interest in our work.
You take it easy.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.